the title's really long. This is I wasn't quite sure what to talk about. So I'll talk about some of the things that we had a brief discussion about last week, which is I've been working on for ages, and rather than tell you about what I've been thinking about discs, which I've only started thinking about since I've been here, I'll tell you what I know a little bit about. Alex Shikashikin, he was a postdoc of mine, he's now at Cambridge, the real Cambridge, not the fake Cambridge in Massachusetts, has done a lot of this work, and he's a really smart young man. And of course, Russell Culsred is the person who inspired all this, because basically I always believe that Russell's wrong, and usually he turns out to be right. But we fight about it, and that's how we get going. Greg and his graduate student from Princeton, Elliot, with lots of discussions, Bill Dorland, Ben Chandran, who's a postdoc of mine, is now at Iowa, and Jim McWilliams, who's sort of my numerical colleague at UCLA, who got us going on the numerics a long time ago, 5 years ago. And Jason Moran, who did some of the early simulations, who's now with Mac Lowe at the American Museum of Natural History. Now, I don't know much about disks, and I don't know much about clusters, but if you're trying to look at what the basic properties of MHD are, MHD turbulence is, in systems that we're interested in, it's kind of hard to measure way inside disks. It's kind of hard to measure way inside stars. And there's probably two places that you can actually study MHD turbulence inside the turbulence. One is the solar wind, which is a special kind of MHD turbulence because it's the magnetic field is dominated by the field that's just combed out of the sun. And so you have these sort of mean fields that come out of the sun that dominate it. And I'm going to argue in this talk that that's a rather different kind of turbulence than you expect in a situation where there's no mean field in the system, there's just random field. But clusters are rather nice things to study MHD turbulence, only they're rather far away, and perhaps that makes it easier. Because they're very big, fairly homogeneous on the scales of the turbulence. Plasmas, very hot, 1 to 10 kilovolts kind of thing in the intercluster medium, and not very dense. They're definitely turbulence. There's been a recent spate of measurements of the turbulence in clusters. It's not quite clear exactly where all that turbulence came from, probably a lot from the initial mergers that formed a cluster, a lot from just gravitational inflow and stuff. Very little from the stirring due to galaxies passing through there. It was probably 1% of the turbulence is due to the wakes of galaxies passing through there. A fair amount may be due to bubbles being expelled from central engines, AGNs, in the center. Usually clusters have some big elliptical galaxy in the middle with an AGN, and stuff gets spewed out of that and rises through the intercluster medium and probably stirs up some turbulence. So talk by Mitch Begelman on this a few weeks ago at UCLA. And one of the most amazing things about these bubbles is how they stay like a bubble as they rise through this medium and don't mix with the medium. And why should they? Because one of the most amazing things about this is that the mean free path in this medium is about 10 kiloparsecs, about the size of the bubbles that you see coming out of the central engine. You should also know that the medium, the typical dynamical timescale for a cluster plasma is about 10 to the 9 years, so much shorter than the timescales of the clusters. So clusters are generally thought to be in hydrodynamic, hydromagnetic equilibrium in some sense. The plasma inside the gravitational well produced by the dark matter. Reynolds number is not very big. The Reynolds number in a cluster medium might only be 100 because the mean free paths are extremely long. And these sort of not very large Reynolds numbers may be typical of some disks too. In fact, disks may have mean free paths bigger than the size of the disk. So this kind of dynamics might be important. But the magnetic Reynolds number of these systems is enormous. It's like 10 to the 29. It's incredibly low resistivity inside this plasma, such that the resistive scales inside the cluster medium, this is a ROSAT image of COMA, I think, And the resistive scales inside him is just incredibly small. But this is rather typical of what you might expect of a medium in which you could study MHD turbulence. And I've been particularly interested in sort of whether there are any universal properties of MHD turbulence that we could understand that we can apply to more complicated systems like disks. And I'm not sure that there are. That's really mostly what I'll talk about. Magnetic field and these things. We know quite a bit about the magnetic field in cluster plasmas because they're often illuminated from behind by some polarized source, so we can measure Faraday rotation through the cluster plasma, and we can see some of these measurements are a little iffy because, in fact, people measure, for instance, the Faraday rotation of jets through the cluster plasma, and then it's very difficult to separate out what's Faraday rotation in the jet and what's Faraday rotation from the plasma around the jet, and whether there's a halo of the jet, and all these kind of issues come in. So there are cleaner measurements when you just have some source way behind the cluster that's polarized, and you measure its Faraday rotation going through. And one of the things about that is that we notice that there's a reversal length in the Faraday rotation, you know, a variation in the Faraday rotation over distances of order 10 to 30 kiloparsecs, something like that. So the magnetic field actually has structure on quite small scales compared to the size of the whole cluster plasma, which might be a megaparsec or two across. My questions that come out of this, and I think these are very relevant questions to jets and disks, is, the first one actually is more relevant to clusters itself, and because it clusters, these kind of plasmas that you have in clusters might be typical of the kind of plasmas that you have in structure-forming regions after the reionization phase in the formation of structure in the universe. And since they're typically like that, one of the questions you would like to know is, you know, when do we grow magnetic fields? When do the first magnetic fields grow in these structures? Could we grow the kind of magnetic field that we later see in galaxies and in clusters themselves in early stages of cluster formation? And although the clusters themselves are evolved, the kind of plasma that you have in them is not too dissimilar from what you might see shortly after reionization phase. And so we may learn something about how magnetic fields are amplified. Even the magnetic fields in clusters themselves, you know, how did they get there? The clusters have a metallicity of about 1/3 solar. So it could be that the magnetic fields in the clusters were spewed out of other objects like galaxies and jets and things like that. But the problem with that is largely that in an object like a galaxy, you have a few microgauss in a plasma that has a density of 1-ish per centimeter, and then it's spewed out into this vast and expanded out into this vast region, which is the cluster, and to densities like 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3, the magnetic field should drop. But in fact, often the magnetic field in clusters is actually stronger than it is in a lot of galaxies. So in the process of being expanded out, it still must be amplified up to the kind of levels that we see. This is very important because the problem with these extremely low resistance plasmas is it's very easy to make all your magnetic energy on extraordinarily small scales. And how is it that we get the structure of the magnetic field that we see in clusters and galaxies and disks, this kind of thing? Is there any universality to MHD beyond the large scale? So you have a disk, you know, and you have an MRI or something and it's an instability. But does it have a spectrum at small scales that's sort of independent of the details of what you do on the large scales? That's an interesting question. Extremely collisionless. As I said, the bubbles that Bagelmann was talking about are only a mean-free path across, roughly. Maybe a little longer than a mean-free path. So collisionless dynamics is extremely important in this kind of turbulence. And this brings up a whole host of questions, and I'll show you that the equations you would like to use are ill-posed and not worth using. And we have to come up with some ideas there. One of the big questions for disks is where does the energy go in MHD turbulence? If you have some instability on some larger scale and it causes a cascade to small scales, How does it do that? Where does it get dissipated? Does it heat electrons? Does it heat ions? All these questions are extremely important in disks. They're important in clusters, only that we know that clusters are being heated, probably by the turbulence in them, because they're radiating and they should be cooling, and they should be cold, but they're not cold, and so that since they're not cold, they must be being heated. But in a cluster, you have plenty of time to reach local thermal equilibrium, and so there's no question that ions and electrons should have roughly the same temperature, for instance. Whereas in a disk, you could have two temperature plasmas and all kinds of things. What does the spectrum of velocity look like that we know in the disk? There's been some measurements recently. So what you expect in any kind of turbulent system is some large scale, maybe this is the scale on which bubbles are being pushed out of central AGNs into the disk, into the cluster plasma, and you get some cascade down to some viscous scale. This is the famous Komovorov cascade, K41, all the turbulence people refer to this paper as, because there's a K41 and a K61. And energy is dissipated at this scale. Should be remembered here that the viscous scales are not small. They're 10 to 30 kiloparsecs in size in a cluster. The viscous scale, though, has a faster turnover rate than these large scales. These large scales might be the scale of the cluster itself, a megaparsec. And the turnover rate at that scale, if you went to the sound speed, is 10 to the 9 years. Whereas the turnover rate of eddies of this scale is 10 to the 8 years. Really a very short time in this kind. And this has been observed by measuring pressure fluctuations in this regime, right? And assuming only partly compressible turbulence. If you know the pressure fluctuations, you can sort of back out the velocity spectrum out of that. And it was observed 2004, there's this paper by Schuker.
Observed in clusters?
This spectrum here, yeah. From here to about here. Okay. The pressure fluctuations are being measured in the clusters, and that spectrum, if they claim is k to the minus 5/3, it's somewhat of an optimistic claim. It falls. It's bigger here than it is down here.
How does Masonicus
pressure fluctuations?
Yeah, how it was measured by satellite, by X-ray observations?
Yeah, X-ray observation mixed temperature. This is the magnetic spectrum, and this is measured from a host of Faraday rotation measurements by Enslin and his group. This is 2003. And that looks, all this is sort of optimistic, but you know, they've got a bunch of sources behind there, and they're measuring the Faraday rotation in all these sources and trying to say what kind of spectra of magnetic field you have in here. It's quite small scale compared to the size of the cluster, so you've got quite a lot of room to sort of maneuver in here, and a fair number of sources behind it. But the claim is sort of flat down to somewhere, right, of order 1 to 10 kiloparsecs, and then drops off. It probably drops off because they can't measure down here, but they claim it drops off because it drops off. One thing, the resistive scale is 10 to the 7 centimeters, 100 kilometers, it's drivable. It's walkable. It's walkable in the day. And it's just not going to be important. I mean,
how do you define the resistive scale?
Well, you've got a time scale.
Pure theoretically.
Right, there's some time scale, or rate, right, which is some typical turbulent time scale, and that would take to be 10 to the 9 years, and then it's eta over L squared, and that's the resistive scale. That's the Spitzer resistivity. Okay? Spitzer resistivity is 10 to the 7 over t to the 3 halves in EV. So you can work it out for here. Anyway, it turns, when you do that sum, it just turns out to be 10 to the 7 centimeters.
What's the typical distance between the radio sources?
Between the sources within there?
No.
Oh, so you mean to get this kind of structure?
Yeah.
Well, they've got some, they've got k
3 and 10 kiloparsecs in some spots, and then they won't have some for a bit. And then, so, you know,
so once
you get down to
a smaller scale, they can mirror.
Yeah, but their argument is this: is that you've got some source here, and you've got some source here, and some source here. You actually see that, you know, when you've got three pretty close together, they measure very similar Faraday rotation measures. And therefore they say, well, you know, then we would expect the scale over which the magnetic field varies not to be very much smaller than that. Right? But they've only got, you know, a handful of sources to measure this spectrum.
But if there's both the large scale component of the field and the small scale is not measured by the Faraday rotation, only the large scale.
Yes. And from the Faraday rotation, you have to back out, because here you've got this blob of stuff and your source is coming through like this. And actually, here's a patch of magnetic field, and here's a patch of magnetic field. And what they do is, looking at the Faraday rotation measure, they decide that the magnetic field has a blobby structure of about that size. And then when you're looking through, then here's the source behind it, and here you're looking, okay? You have to take the square root of n to estimate the size of the field, because you've gone through n structures as you go through the blob of plasma. So, you know, this is not my data, and I'm not going to defend it very heavily, but there is some evidence for some magnetic field energy spread over here, and they claim it's roughly flat. I like that, because it agrees with my theory.
Resistive scale only pure theoretical. There's no observations.
No observations at all. That was just the Switzer resistive scale.
Physics involved, therefore, will be another, because artificial, some mechanism.
Yes, I hope
principle
so.
May be absolutely
yes,
different.
I'm looking for it.
It's only your point of view.
No, it's a standard definition of the resistive scale.
Just a given
number. It's based on measured temperature.
No, but what is different between resistive scale and metrical, physically?
What's the difference between the resistivity?
Ion viscosity versus electron resistivity.
I mean, it's a very different quantity. The ratio of the viscosity to the resistivity in this case is 10 to the 24. You know, it's huge.
Viscosity is large, resistivity is small.
Viscosity is large. The Reynolds number of this flow is like 10 to the 2.
This conductivity is also large.
Sir?
Conductivity is also very large.
Conductivity is huge.
Huge. And that means that Mintley Potter is big for resistivity. There's no dissipation, no overhead dissipation.
The mean free path is about between 1 and 10 kiloparsecs.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't understand why resistive scale is so small. It also should be
huge. Huge difference between this. Free path lengths and.
The mean free path doesn't. They scale the other way.
For high conductivity.
For high conductivity.
The resistivity
you don't
small.
Take the resistivity to be, the resistive scale to be the mean free path.
As the temperature goes up, the mean free path gets longer and the resistivity drops. It's a standard plot.
Yeah, free path goes like t squared, resistivity goes like 1 over t to the 3 halves. I mean, we see this, the resistive, if you look at Tokamak, right, the mean free path is,
a
1,000 kilometers, right?
Yeah.
1,000 meters. Maybe a kilometer. And the resistive scale is about that big.
But just physically, viscosity comes due to interaction between ions, basically, right?
Yes.
And resistivity is interaction with electrons which are ions.
It's the drag of the electrons in the ions.
Right.
Yeah.
That's where the difference comes.
Yeah.
Not only that.
Even opposite scales. There's actually very interesting here. I thought I'd take you through some history. This is the physicist in me, because it's very interesting. If you take a box of a conducting fluid and you just stir it randomly, homogeneous random turbulence. We haven't known until very recently that the magnetic field in homogeneous random turbulence would actually amplify. Right? Over the history since the Second World War and people started thinking about these things, people have changed their minds about 3 times as to whether it did. And it's only through computers that everybody has become convinced. In fact, Leon Mastorf, 2 years ago in Durham, told me categorically I had to be wrong. There was no such thing as a homogeneous isotropic dynamo. And he said that he and Batchelor had argued about it through the 1950s and the 1960s, and that he was definitely right. But he was the only person in the world who agreed that, because now we have a lot of numerical evidence that exists. But if you go back, you know, MHD was sort of invented around World War II by people in colder climates. Lundquist and people in the Baltic states and stuff. But in 1950, there's a remarkable paper by Batchelor. Batchelor had been to a conference on the ISM in Paris, and he was working on homogeneous turbulence in fluids. And there was a lot of talk about MHD turbulence at this meeting, and he came back, and he realized since the magnetic field behaved very much like vorticity, in incompressible turbulence, it obeys the same equation. But what he knew about vorticity, he could apply to magnetic field, and he predicted that in homogeneous turbulence, you would grow magnetic field on small scales, just like you grow vorticity on small scales in turbulence, and that the turbulence will amplify the field. Then Biermann and Schlüter in 1951 says, well, if it's going to amplify the field, well, we know it's always going to go to equipartition, so that if we know the spectrum of the velocity fluctuations, we know the spectrum of the magnetic field fluctuations. It's just k to the minus 5/3. Kolmogorov was right for MHD2, right? That's basically what they said. And there was a realization first by Kraepner and Neroshnikov, whose name I haven't put on here, but I should, because he's actually was slightly before Kraepner. Who said, well, you know, the small-scale part of this ought to look like Alphane waves. All the small-scale part of MHD turbulence ought to look like Alphane waves. And Kraepner derived a spectrum, which we now know not to be quite correct, because he assumed isotropy. And then there was Goldreich and his team who've followed up there. And Montgomery and Matthew seem to think they got there first, and I'm not sure. So there was a whole bunch of stuff saying homogeneous MHD turbulence exists, it gives you equipartition scale by scale, and that's all you have to know about small scale MHD turbulence. About the same time, in the late 50s though, Parker and Zeldovich and Krauss and Radler and various people realized it was very important in turbulence whether you had helicity and how you actually stirred the field at the large scale. And that was the sort of birth of the Alpha Omega dynamo era and all that stuff that came along. And people started to not really care whether there was such a thing as a homogeneous dynamo. Right? Now, for things like clusters, there's almost no rotation. So really, most of the turbulence inside the cluster has got to be fairly homogeneous and isotropic. And so I do care. You may not care. In 1963, Batchelor student Keith Moffat, and in his book in 1978, said there is no magnetic field amplification by homogeneous turbulence. It doesn't happen, right? Batchelor's argument was wrong because magnetic field doesn't have the same sources as when you stir a fluid, you produce a source of vorticity. You don't produce a source of magnetic field, and he claimed that it didn't exist. But in the meantime, the Russians, who were ignoring us, not really, but these were the British, and here were the Russians. In 67, Kazantsev solved the delta-correlated model of the homogeneous dynamo. Delta-correlated meaning he assumed that the velocities were just these little jitters, like this, right? And in that case, he could solve the equations for the magnetic field in a homogeneous isotropic case, and he was able to show that there would be a dynamo, and it was followed up by Feinstein and a whole crowd of Zeldovich's people. And Cosrin and Anderson, kind of came along on this in 1990. That's actually where I got started because I was at Princeton at the time working with Russell. And what we didn't know was the delta correlated model relevant? It's not real turbulence, it's jitters like this. And how do those jitters actually make, you know, look like real turbulence, which delta correlated assumes that the correlation time is much shorter, right, than the time to turn an eddy over, which is either large or small Kubo number. I forget which way up the Kubo number is. But basically, what it means is that no eddy turns all the way over before it decorrelates. Right? But in real turbulence, typically an eddy turns all the way over before it decorrelates, and it wasn't sure how relevant that was. And this is where computers come in, really. Beneguzzi and Pouquet in 1982, I think, somebody might correct me on this, did the first homogeneous MHD turbulent dynamo numerically. It was Prandtl number one, it was 64 cubed, and they actually grew a magnetic field. Not a very strong magnetic field. It ended up with B squared being, I think, 0.16 times V squared. So it's not a very efficient dynamo. It didn't get very far. And then a whole slew of people have done it, and I mentioned us, basically, and nobody else, but a whole slew of people have done similar things after that, getting to larger and larger scales. And the largest scale, I think, was Brandenburg and Howland recently did a 1,000 cubed compressible simulation, where the compressibility was rather weak because they stirred at low Mach number and showed dynamo action there. But what we've discovered is that the dynamo action does depend critically on the small scale.
You don't need geotropic turbulence for it.
No, this is isotropic turbulence. And I said for a long time people debated whether it would be true or not, and it's taken until really now when we've got good computer simulations to say, yes, you really can make this work. Now, most of the plasma, you know, when it becomes really plasma physics, it's usually true that the mean free path is quite long, temperature is quite high, and this ratio of viscosity to resistivity is a very large number, the magnetic Prandtl number. In this case, the magnetic field can go to very small scales without being dissipated, but the velocities cannot be on small scales. There's no reason why a large-scale velocity can't make a small-scale field. You just take an eddy, like this, and typically in an eddy the middle is rotating a bit faster than the outside, always happens with things going in circles, and you put a magnetic field through it, and what it'll do, it'll take a field line that was previously straight and wrap it up into this spiral structure like that, and the more it rotates, the more it wraps this up. And so there's no reason why large-scale velocities can't make extremely small-scale fields. This is a misconception that seems to be very universal. People believe that to make small-scale fields, you need small-scale velocities. You can then wrap this up, and I mean, this problem done years ago, but you can then wrap this up until the reversals of the field across here become on the resistive scale, right? And then it would start to dissipate due to resistance. As I say, the homogeneous dynamo, it's a bit weird because you kind of imagine we also knew by this time, of course, that two-dimensional dynamos absolutely don't work. And so we had this idea, of course, with homogeneous, it was sort of like doing dye. Right? You put red dye into homogeneous turbulence, and you stir it, and you get little streaks of redness within your water, and eventually the water just all becomes pink, and diffusion takes over, and the whole thing washes out. And we sort of believe that in homogeneous turbulence you do this to the magnetic field, and eventually it would just all mix to small scales, and at small scales resistance would kill it. That doesn't happen. This is a case where we just take, I think this, most of these were 256 cubed simulations, and just to show you that it works, this is B squared versus time for a number of different Prandtl numbers in the simulation, going from relatively small Prandtl numbers up to large Prandtl numbers. And you start with a weak field. This is a box. It's a spectral, incompressible MHD simulation in a box. And you start with a magnetic field just randomly put into the box, and it starts to grow. And it grows, it has a little intermittency in it, and it grows up, and this growth rate here corresponds very closely to the theoretical one. And it reaches saturation at rough equipartition with the velocity.
There's no mean field.
No mean field. No, we start actually with k equals 1 and k equals 2 magnetic fields in the box. No k equals 0 magnetic field in the box. It just grows up, and comes to saturation like that. And this was, for instance, these are the saturated V squared, the circles, and the filled in circles are the magnetic field. And as long as you get to high enough Prandtl number, you always find that the magnetic field energy is comparable with the turbulent energy that you're in there. So it's an efficient dynamo. It converts V squared into B squared.
From
this plot, it's not clear what happens in the almost all the cases. Is that stopped the simulation?
Oh, that was actually to look at the growth rate here. I pulled this out of one of our papers. The growth rate is a function of the parental number.
Okay, so what happens then? How do you...
Well, we just stopped there. We just stopped. But these ones go up and saturate.
At the same level? Or
No, lower growth rate ones always saturate. You've actually got saturations of similar ones here. These are different parental numbers. So here's the magnetic field saturation. Essentially grows with parental number. Right? This is parental number. That's the magnetic field energy. Right? This is the velocity energy. That's typical.
So starting at a few hundred, you get this. It's independent of the...
Yes. Once you get to a few hundred, you get to about V squared is equal to B squared.
On what scale?
Okay.
Essentially, on what scale?
I'm coming to that. That's what I'm about to talk about. It's taken me this long to get this one. This is a picture of it during the amplification phase. And the thing you immediately see, and this is typical of what happens, we have eddies. This is a large parental number case. So this is like an eighth of the simulation, I think. Something like an eighth of the simulation. And we just took a cut through it. The magnetic field strength is the gray scale, so white is strong and black is dark. And this, the projection of the magnetic field vectors is these red vectors, if you can see them. You've got relatively large stirring eddies, right, from the turbulence that you're stirring in there. We force it with some random forcing. And what it does is it combs out the magnetic field due to the shear in these things, but it combs it out positive and negative. And what you get is a very folded structure of the field where you can see here going in one direction, and you see a reversals here and here, and then there's another reversal here, and there's a bunch of reversals in here. I can't point them all out. But what you get is highly folded field, where the field doesn't vary much along itself, but it varies very much across itself. So you get reversals of the field like this inside that.
What's shown in
grayscale? So the strength of the magnetic field. Yeah.
Can you please tell which equations are solved?
MHD, incompressible MID.
With which transport coefficients?
Well, viscosity is scalar viscosity here. This is nu del squared V. In the momentum equation, and eta del squared b, in the
eta, both are determined by Coulomb collisions.
Yeah. Is it just called constants?
They're constants, and so in this simulation, I think it's parental number 500. So this is nu over eta equal to 500.
Okay, so they are adjusted so that as follows from Coulomb collision.
Well, this would tell me this. There would be a certain temperature if this were true, right? But I can't get the Prandtl number, the real Prandtl number of a cluster, which is 10 to the 24. The ratio of these two in a cluster is 10 to the 24. I'm not going to do that. I don't have the right computers.
So you start with a homogeneous magnetic field and turbulent flow. Is that right? And then
that's homogeneous.
No. I just start with a random magnetic field and I start stirring the. No, I put my knitting needle in there. I start stirring the turbulence.
But don't do it with the needle.
But you're
I do it in K-space.
So that's what I said. The knitting needle is on one scale. And
it's on. I stir on K equals 1 and a bit of K equals 2.
Okay, slightly on the large scale.
On the large scale. Okay. Right? I get a very limited cascade in this case because I cannot, since I've got rather small resistivity. My viscosity can't be terribly small because I've still got to resolve the scales on which the magnetic field goes to, right? So since I've got to find where the magnetic field scales are, the viscosity is quite large. And so this isn't a very large Reynolds number flow. In fact, the Reynolds number, I think, is like 5. You can't do simultaneously large Reynolds number, large magnetic Reynolds number, and all that, and get it into a computer. It's one of our problems. Oh, this was, by the way, in the saturated state, and it looks even more folded, actually, in the saturated state. The folds tend to be a little more pronounced in the saturated state.
And you don't generate
any into... You rigorously can't generate any. In a spectral simulation, you'll never generate any K. Yeah. It's a pseudospectral.
So you can understand why you develop such a thing. It's, you take a little box of plasma like this, right? And inside the turbulent flow, what does such a box do? Such a box gets stretched in one direction and compressed in the other direction because it's going to conserve its volume. And so you have a little piece of magnetic field that maybe looks like that in the box. And what happens to it is it gets stretched out like that, right? And what you naturally get is this folded structure. Just anything gets stretched into that kind of way. And the field lines align with the direction of the stretching. That's always that. You see this in your simulations of disks, you know, because you've got differential rotation, you're going to tend to elongate in the toroidal direction. Now, because we're in turbulence though, right, that eddy that was stretching, it goes away. There's another eddy that comes up and it starts to, and it takes what that was and it bends it over. It bends it over like that and it makes a corner in the field. And then later on, what's going to happen is you're going to pick up this and that, and you're going to stretch in this direction and compress in this direction. Because it's incompressible, you've got to be compressing at least in one direction. Right? And what happens is you take corners and you stretch apart the magnetic field lines, and in the bits where you compress, you push them together. Now, wherever you push the magnetic field together, you amplify the field. Where you pull it apart, you obviously make the field weaker. So it's very interesting. Actually, we worked out all the statistics on this, and I'm not going to show you a lot of math, but the one thing that agrees between the analysis, agrees to high precision between the analysis that we've done using delta correlated models and the computation, is we were able to work out the probability distribution function of the curvature of magnetic field lines, right? And that agrees beautifully between simulations and theory, and the anti-correlation between the magnitude of B and curvature. One of the things you would say is, well, we're making these folds. Don't they have a lot of curvature force in the corners, right? You bend the field lines very much in the corners. But they don't, because the field is weak in the corners, right? And the actual curvature force in the corners doesn't mean that you slingshot back out of this. You would have thought, I'm stretching it, magnetic field gets very strong, and it slingshots back, but it doesn't in the corners. And in fact, this is a sort of, you call that a minimum curvature state. So as you go along, this still doesn't explain why you have a homogeneous dimer, because what happens in that case is that everywhere you make the field strong, sorry, in the previous case, where you make the field strong, you make the reversals very close together, and you would expect resistance to wipe this out. Right? You've got field going one direction and then the other direction, and resistance would wipe it out. So you want to find mechanisms for amplifying the field without making the field go to small scale. You'd like it to get strong, but not small scale, because otherwise you'll wipe it out with resistance. And there is a mechanism to do that. Instead of compressing in this direction, you compress in the third direction. And that's why you can only do this in three dimensions. It's only because whenever you do the compression, you do it in the direction the field doesn't change. Right? Now, those are only a subset of the statistical turbulent motions. Some of them compress like that, and some of them compress in the third direction. So it's only the ones that compress in the third direction that actually yield the dynamo action. And it's actually three-eighths of the motion, in some statistical sense, does that.
And magnetic pressure doesn't arrive.
Well, eventually, magnetic pressure gets strong enough that it and the tension forces, that you can't bend it anymore. So when you take your box like this, and you drop some magnetic field into it, and you turn on your stirring, and you start turbulence. It's the fastest eddies in the box that do the initial growth of turbulence. It's the small ones, right, which are the viscous eddies, that are actually turning over fast ones. The ones at large scale have long turnover times in Kolmogorov turbulence, and the ones at small scale have short turnover times, and they wrap up the field very rapidly. So if you had, for instance, a bit like we were talking about in the simulations we were talking about the other day, you start up some kind of instability and it produces small turbulent scales. Those small scales are the ones that are going to initially wrap up the field until the field gets strong enough that it can oppose the motions at this scale. Right, so the initial growth of magnetic field in all our simulations happens below the viscous scales, between the viscous scales and the resistive scales. Right? And this is all highly tangled, folded field, folding on scales much smaller than the viscous scale in there. And you can actually, in the delta correlated model, write down essentially the Green's function for that. And it shows that you have this k to the 3 halves spectrum of magnetic field peaking down at small scale. But as it grows, it's going to get strong enough that that sort of, you know, it's like tangled knitting wool. It's eventually, right, it's grown to a strength that it opposes these eddies, and then it starts to feed back on this. Because these eddies are weak but fast, right? These ones are stronger but slow. So once these ones have been saturated, these ones can still fold the field. And when these have been saturated, these ones can. And you do a growth up this region.
But wait, I have two questions about this expression. First one is gamma. And second, there is a minus.
Gamma is the turnover rate of that eddy. Okay. Right.
And so there is a minus sign? Oh, it's OK.
If you look at
when the time is small, the first term dominates, and you just have very, very fast.
Well, when time is small, this reduces to the delta function at some initial k. And then what it does is it spreads out from there. The peak moves to the right, but it grows at every scale.
Yeah. Right?
And that's that business. It has to grow at the large scales as well as the small scales, because if everything moved to the right, it would all disappear into resistivity and it would be wiped out. It's the fact that at every scale, the response grows. Andrei Gruzinov and I published a paper about how that only happens in dimensions between 2.3 and 8.1, I think. Andrei needed a publication. So we did develop, and I'm not going to show you this, but we did develop a theory of the saturation in this case, because it goes on and it keeps this folded structure right up to saturation. When you get to saturation, you've got fields that look like this. And they got so strong that you can't bend them anymore. So most of the stirring tends to produce interchange-like motions. It produces motions perpendicular to the field, but not bending the field. And so what we did was we went and we took the delta-correlated theory, and we said that what would happen is we would lose the local isotropy of turbulence. We were more likely to have motions like that than motions like that. And then we adjusted the amount of isotropy until we got that the field no longer grew. Right? So we just adjusted a parameter in the isotropy until we got a solution for the spectrum in which the field no longer grew. And that was this shape. And then we adjusted the size of the spectrum to fit. And the black is numerical and the red is analytic. So this model, which says that the process of saturating the magnetic field grows and coming to some equilibrium between the turbulence and the magnetic field, is entirely due to the fact that the turbulence becomes locally anisotropic. And it becomes motions like this and not motions like that.
Yes, so this...
I really showed it just to show that we actually had some success with this project.
Red lines agree with the black lines.
The red lines agree with the black lines. But the red lines are this model where we inhibit, we introduce anisotropy, right, until the field, we get that. We adjust the anisotropy so the field no longer grows. And that gives us the shape of the spectrum, and then we just adjust the size of the spectrum to fit. And so, in a sense, we're explaining the shape but not the actual magnitude of the magnetic field.
So there is a displacement of the maximum?
Yes, these are different Prandtl numbers. Yeah, low Prandtl number, we're just increasing Prandtl number, and you can see the whole thing just moves out.
I just want to extract
this is the velocity spectrum. This is the velocity spectrum, right? So you can see this is not a high Reynolds number flow. This is a low Reynolds number flow with a relatively large magnetic Reynolds number. Right? We just don't have space in the computer. And it turns out we found we cannot use hyperresistivity, which would allow us to come right up to the edge of this resolution here. We cannot use it because it destroys the folding structure, and we don't know why. If we could, we could get more effective resolution out of our boxes. So the only pictures you should take away from this is success and that as you reduce the resistivity, you just get more and more small-scale field. This is not what we see. This is not what astrophysics says. Right? We don't get small-scale field in astrophysics. But in the simulations of homogeneous turbines, what you end up with is a spectrum of magnetic field that's entirely dominated by small-scale faults. Some hope, though, since those simulations were a small Reynolds number, even on the very large, we've been doing 512 cube simulations, we cannot get simultaneously a good inertial range of the turbulence and a large range between viscous scale and resistive scale. That's just too much for the computer. That will be two asymptotic ranges, and really we can only get one out of the computer at this stage. But there was some hope that when you had a full range here, that you would come into equipartition, some inverse cascade, even in the homogeneous case, that the magnetic field that was tied up in these folds on small scales would somehow inverse cascade into becoming like this. This is what Kreitner, Goldreich, etc. said the spectrum's going to look like in the inertial range. It's just going to be alphane waves from there to there. Doesn't matter what's stirring it, the inertial range would look like alphane waves. I can't tell you that that's not true. I can tell you that the numerical evidence is against that. Here is some saturated velocity spectrum. This is only 128 cubed, so it's not a very big one. Its Prandtl number equals 1. And this is the magnetic spectrum in the saturated case. So there's velocity, there's magnetic. And this is Prandtl number equals 1. When we increase the Prandtl number, the magnetic spectrum goes out to here, goes out to here, and the velocity spectrum does not change. So there's no sign of scale by scale velocity and magnetic field equipartition in magnetic turbulence without a mean field. This is to be contrasted with this picture down here, which is a picture from Jason Moran's thesis with Peter Goldreich. It's actually from the paper, of course. But this is the spectra when you have a mean field, same code actually, because it was Jason's code we used for this one, and same code, but when you put on a strong mean field, then everything has to be alphane waves, and then you get scale by scale B and velocity spectrum. And nothing in here looks like folded fields. This just looks like straight field lines with little wiggles on them. Okay? And not like this at all. My claim is that this is very special. This is what you see in the solar wind. Right? And you see it in the solar wind because there's a nice strong field coming out of the sun. This is more that I'd expect to see in a...
And if you have mean field, doesn't happen again.
So we've actually done a bunch of simulations recently, scaling the size of the mean field to see what that does. And in fact, this competing with this simulation here was one by Cho and Lazarian and Vishniak, who at the time published one in which the field had 1/3 equipartition strength. So the mean field squared was 1/3 of the mean velocity squared. In that case, you got a little folding, but mostly just alphane waves. And we find that at about 1/10, right, equipartition value on the mean field, we transition from one state to the other. But I don't know, there should be some scaling on that 10th. I don't think 10 is a universal number.
So
maybe it's pi squared.
Strong field, yeah. And this is agrees with Goldreich-Rietveld?
This, well, almost.
Oh, right.
Because according to Peter, it agrees with Goldreich-Rietveld. According to Jason, it doesn't. The slope is closer to minus 5 at 3/2 than it is to minus 5/3.
Well, 3/2 is it?
Yeah, but, I mean, 3/2 and 5/3 aren't very different either. But they have a dispute as to why it's not exactly
3/2. 3/2 is the Roshan of Kreitner.
Yes, but remember, Roshan of Kreitner was really isotropic. They did show was that it was very anisotropic, and that the scaling of the parallel wave numbers with the perpendicular wave numbers was very much like Goldreich-Rietveld. So
in this
exact simulation. This is their best simulation in that paper. And so, yes, they had actually shown the basic structure of Goldreich Sridhar was probably correct, right? But they hadn't, there was this problem with the actual spectral index here. Now, Jason thinks this is a serious problem, and Peter thinks it's just maybe some intermittency issues.
Just quickly, how large the material has to be to get this tool?
Well, I don't know exactly, but we've just done some studies in which we varied it from sort of zero to much bigger than v squared. Right, so it's b squared naught, which is the mean field, compared to sort of the RMS v squared that you have to compare it to. And when this gets to be about a tenth, we seem to make the transition. Okay, which means that the RMS values are the square root of it.
It doesn't have to be a very strong field.
It doesn't have to be stronger than the turbine. Yes. And there's some questions about what happens when you're compressible for that too.
Is it compressible?
These simulations were all incompressible.
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 And does this depend on the Prandtl number, or is it for Prandtl number equal to 1?
I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
That's something, you know, we had a student working on at Cambridge. Okay, and this was actually probably the topic of my talk, but it seems I've got 2 minutes left. So actually, in a cluster, we are doing this. We're making the viscosity equal to that in the code. We just make it the scale of viscosity. Everybody puts this as their viscosity in the code. That's not what happens in a magnetized plasma. In a magnet, this is good for the galaxy, which is where we started doing these simulations for turbulence in the galaxy, because there's lots of neutrals around, particularly helium, which means the neutrals can cross the field lines, and they have a mean free path across the field lines, and they provide most of the viscosity in the ISM. Right? Even in the hot ISM, you have enough neutrals around that they can do this, because charged particles can only go basically a Lama radius across the field line, which is a lot shorter than the mean free path in all of these plasmas. Right? It's the Lama radius in 10 to the 8 centimeters or something like that in the cluster. Okay, so it's a very short distance. And so you cannot transfer momentum across field lines by motion of the charged particles. And that's, of course, viscosity is the transfer of momentum over a mean free path. But what you do have is a phenomenon called magnetic pumping, which produces something that is called the parallel viscosity in Brzezinski's equations, which are the fluid equations of the plasma. And it works like this. You have a magnetic field line and a particle going around the magnetic field line. If it's going around sufficiently fast and you're changing the field slowly, then you conserve the magnetic moment. V pub squared over B. It's the first adiabatic invariant. The pressure must be, because of the fast motion around the field line, must consist of a perpendicular pressure and a parallel pressure. And that the off-diagonal elements of the pressure tensor, as we call them, must be much smaller because they're gyro-averaged over this. So we can have a small difference between the perpendicular and parallel pressures when we're in a relatively collisionless plasma. But when you've got collisions, it tends to locally produce a Maxwellian, which is isotropic, where the parallel pressure and the perpendicular pressure are the same. But, see, so the perpendicular pressure is just the average of V perp squared, and the parallel pressure is given by that. Okay. So now, imagine you're in a compressing field where we've got some flow in our turbulent flow that's compressing the field lines like this. So the field is going up right there. Right? What's happening, because of the conservation of the adiabatic invariant, is the B is going up, so the V perp is going up. But as the field lines are almost straight, the parallel velocity of the particle is completely unaffected. So the perpendicular pressure is going up, but the parallel pressure is staying roughly the same as you converge the field lines in, like this. Okay. And so if you take P perp and you subtract, so because dB dt is going up like this, you've got a rate of change of the perpendicular pressure. But collisions are then scattering that back to isotropize. So you've got competition between raising the perpendicular pressure and collisions that are scattering them back to isotropize and make uniform pressure. And so the difference between the perpendicular and the parallel pressure is the rate you're increasing it divided by the rate you're decreasing it, which is the collision rate. Okay. So the times the pressure. Should have a pressure in there. And so this is the difference between the perpendicular and the parallel pressure.
I assume that the collisions are Romanian collisions.
Well, if
this difference is small.
Okay, this is the rate of increase of the magnetic field. If you have Kolmogorov turbulence, that's as fast as the eddy turnover rate of the smallest eddy. As long as that's less than the collision rate, this is a small number. Okay, which it is in Kolmogorov turbulence. If you put that into the fluid equations, you don't have viscosity, but you have this term. Right? But Brzezinski worked this all out in gory detail using Sonnian polynomials and stuff. And it's well known, and you can look it up in all the books. And this term is called the parallel viscosity. And it's proportional to the P over nu times this, which is basically the rate of change of the strength of the magnetic field. So this equation, we replace where we had viscosity by this term here.
Kinetic instability is very important here?
Well, I'm about to get to that. I think I can get to that without keeping you here until past your bedtime. So this was what we thought would help us out here. Because if you think about this folded structure, we've got a field line like this. What stops it unwinding to some extent is the fact that this is, they're viscously damped flows on this scale. This distance between here and here is very small, and so all flows on this scale are viscously damped, and it's hard to get little jetting action. But with this kind of viscosity, the Alphane wave is not damped at all. If you put this into the equation and you calculate the dispersion relation for an Alphane wave, right, you would say it's not damped. In a plasma, right, where you're not amplifying the field, Alphane waves are not affected by this viscosity. Slow waves are. Slow waves get magnetic pumping and they're damped by this. So we thought that this would help unwind, and then Russell's student, Leonid Malishkin, who's not a student anymore, many of us aren't, published this paper in which they said this would help get rid of the folding in this turbulence, and therefore we would be able to have a sensible spectrum of MHD, right? I.e. one that looked like it was in equipartition or something like that. I didn't agree with that, but I didn't know why. And then so Russell came over to Imperial last summer, and we tried to work out this some more, and we got a big surprise. So as you're stretching a magnetic field line, you're doing this kind of action where you pull it out and you're compressing it in this direction, and idealized. Right here the field is decreasing, and right here the field is increasing. So right in these corners here, the parallel pressure is bigger than the perpendicular pressure, and over here the parallel pressure is less than the perpendicular pressure. Now it's known from plasma theory that when you have anisotropic pressure, you're unstable to two kinds of instability. When this is true, fire hose, and when this is true, mirror instabilities. Right? And they're even unstable in Brzezinski's equations, and I didn't know this until last summer when we tried to calculate the evolution of the flows in these folds, and we kept getting nonsense, and Greg and Russell and I and Alex Schicken were trying to ponder this, and suddenly we realized we were being stupid. If you just take field lines converging like this, or diverging like this, straight like this, and you do a linear stability analysis of that case, and you take Brzezinski's equation like that, and you perturb it, and you look at the perturbed force on the right-hand side, there's the usual perturbation of the net pressure, there's some perturbation here along the magnetic field line forces, but the important one is B squared times the curvature of the field. That's the thing that produces the Alphane wave. When you bend a field line, it wants to spring back, is that term. But you have an extra term, which is P parallel minus P perp, right, times the curvature of the field line. And that doesn't have a sign, right? Because we could have P parallel bigger than P perp, so this could be negative. So if you look at the force, when you bend a field line, and you have the difference between P parallel and P per, you have a force. So here's the field line bent like that. You have a force in this direction that's proportional to B squared minus P parallel minus P per. So if you're amplifying field from a very low level, that's negligible. And so the force, so B squared's tiny. So if P parallel is bigger than P per, you actually have a force in the opposite direction. You bend the field line, it wants to go on bending. And that's what's called the fire hose instability. And so it's in Brzezinski's equations.
There's a parenthesis around your P parallel lines.
So there's, if you analyze this, you can get a growth rate for this mode out of here, which is k parallel squared. If we didn't have p parallel minus p perp, that would be the Alfvén wave, minus p parallel minus p perp over rho. Right? And when we're at low field, early stages of the dynamo, this is negligible. And if this is bigger than this, this is a growing mode. And it's proportional to k parallel squared. And therefore, the smallest scale in your simulation will be the most unstable, right? And so if you just put this on the computer, they look like perfectly dissipative equations. They look like they were well behaved. What you will find is noise grows up at the smallest scale in your simulation, and it's the growth of these fire hose instabilities, this is called a fire hose, at the smallest scale. It's always unstable until the field gets strong enough that it's being stabilized. In fact, if you do kinetic theory,
this is what you actually find.
Simulation,
that's what you actually.
Jason put Brzezinski's.
Because it's got real find.
We put Brzezinski's viscous tensor into the code, and it was really hard work because the viscous tensor depends on the direction of the magnetic field.
Yeah.
You get magnetic field in there four times. Right? And so you're doing a pseudo-spectral code. You have to worry about all the de-aliasing of something that's non-linear in four things inside there. And you have to resolve the direction of the magnetic. So we were very worried about accuracy issues on putting that tensor in there. So we put it in, and we ran the code, and we got all kinds of noise. Right? And Jason wanted to publish it in his paper because he said, I did it. I was the first person to do it. And I said, no, we don't really know what's going on. He said, but we're getting all this extra velocity, and I said, no, I don't believe it. Let's not publish this. You'll find it on AstroPH, actually, because it was in the AstroPH, but not in the paper. And I said, no, we can't publish this. And the code was probably right. The code was probably actually generating fire hose instabilities down near the grid scale, and he was solving the equations correctly, but what does it mean?
Well, you could just use this code to set up a problem to study the fire. I mean, to see whether you have a fire.
We could now, with subsequent knowledge, and that sort of, in fact, Pratik Sharma and Greg are doing a more sophisticated version of that issue right now. But what you find, of course, it's unstable to the smaller scales that you have in your box. And it goes all the way down, if you do plasma theory, kinetic theory, all the way down to the scales of the Lama radius. And the fastest growing instability is down on the scales of the Lama radius, and it has a growth rate which is a little bit smaller than the ion cyclotron period of the ions. Right? It's sort of a second. It's incredibly fast growth rate of these very small scale instabilities. My guess, right? As to what, so this is just my little cartoon of how the fire hose works. You've got this parallel pressure, and it is like a fire hose. You kink it up, and the parallel pressure pushes the whole thing upwards, and it gets kinkier and kinkier. I come from LA, we like that kind of thing. So if you plotted the scales in this thing, it's unbelievable, right? Here's the scale of the cluster. This is the viscous scale here. This is the 10 to the 8 years is that kind of time scale. So the mean free path is down at a few kiloparsecs. We think the magnetic field is probably up here. There may be some down here. But the growth rate of this instability stretches down to 10 to the 5 kilometers sort of scale down here. And We don't quite know what to do with that, but probably what it's doing, and we'd like to know this, is it produces a much enhanced scattering. Right? You've got this incredibly, on small scales, incredibly wiggly field line like that. And what's really going to happen is the iron's going along, this is on the scale of the motion of the iron. Right? It's going to get scattered in that. And what you've got is an effective mean-free path that's not much longer than this distance, which is the iron lava radius, which is only 10 to the 8 centimeters or something, 10 to the 9 centimeters in this case. And this effectively reduces the mean-free path to an incredibly small scale, making MHD theory actually rather good, because you've got this effective collisionality that's much, much stronger. And this has all kinds of implications for transport, particularly in clusters where it seems to be that the heat transport is suppressed, right? If you have this enhanced scattering due to these small-scale plasma instabilities, you may have a suppression of all the transport processes. It might say why bubbles don't mix with the rest of the with the rest of the cluster. That might just be magnetic insulation, but it could be that, you know, these anomalous collisions stop the mixing of the hot stuff and the cold stuff. So all kinds of structural clusters that could explain. But it does something really weird. It means that the viscosity is much, much smaller than its nominal value, because viscosity is proportional to 1/1 over the collision rate. And so if you enhance the collisions, the plasma becomes far less viscous. Right? The pressure becomes isotropic. And that means that you would have velocity scales down to very much smaller scales, which means you have much faster eddies in your turbulence, which means you can amplify the field much faster. And so it could affect the dynamo in a sort of explosive manner, whereas you have initial motion causes these instabilities, causes enhanced viscosity, collisions, cause reduced viscosity, causes an enormous amount of turbulent energy to cascade to very small scales where it can amplify the field very rapidly. And you can go through all kinds of scenarios of how that happens. That's my talk, and I'm sorry it ran over.
So that's even more problematic compared with observation that scale, B field scale, it's kiloparsec rather than.
Okay, so enhanced scattering. Here we're really talking about enhanced scattering of iron. What we'd like is enhanced scattering of electrons so that the resistivity got large. See, enhanced collisions makes viscosity small, but it makes resistivity large. If some of these instabilities made the resistivity large, then the magnetic field could only be at large scales. So if we could get an effective resistivity that was much larger than the actual Spitzer resistivity, right, then there'd be no problem explaining why the field was so smooth. And in fact, you go through all of plasma astrophysics, and everybody could do with a much larger resistivity. It would help their codes too.
In the case of magnetized plasma, you have a lot more. If it's covered in magnetic field, then you don't have such a huge mean-free path. It's restricted by a lot more radius, which is so many orders of magnitude smaller. So actually, the viscosity should be much, much lower.
That's what I just said.
You mentioned plasma, but from the beginning, if there is magnetic field, then it's a lot more scale that reminds the viscosity.
No. The viscosity comes. Calling it viscosity is a bit funny. Producers call it viscosity, but the effective viscosity is this p parallel minus p per. Term. It's called parallel viscosity in Brzezinski's article.
How come in Brzezinski's case you have a collisional plasma, so you have an isotropic pressure? If you start calculation of Brzezinski viscosity, you should start from isotropic pressure, and then all additional terms that don't change the thermodynamic radius, like in Chapman-Cowling.
let me go back to that. I thought I addressed that problem, but I'll go back to it.
When you introduce this anisotropic viscosity, it means that you mix with collisionless plasma, which does not present in magnetic conservation.
Brzezinski's equations, this is called pi. It's the viscosity.
Yeah, but in his case, p parallel is equal to p.
No, it's not. P parallel is not equal to p perp. It's p perp minus p parallel is equal to that, and he inserts that in the equation. That's what it is.
And small p is just water.
This is small in the llama, in the mean free path. It's the vector of the magnetic field. It's the unit vector of the magnetic
field.
This is the unit vector. That's the
capital P and
capital
P
over there.
Which, this one?
This
is pressure. That's n times t.
The first equation is pretty as well.
Yeah.
And it's
a scale.
Anisotropic part?
That's the isotropic part, and this is the anisotropic part. And this is has to be small compared to that. It's a transport term.
Small b is a perpendicular plus p parallel divided by 2.
Yes.
A capital P, what is it? Is it pressure or it's...
This. Uh-huh. This is defined as the average of half mv per squared
and
of the particles.
P, and small p?
That's the average of v squared.
Of b squared?
V squared.
V squared.
Half mv squared.
Yeah.
Once you're in a plasma in which the gyro motion is fast, then the pressure tensor has to be of that form, because all motion around the thing averages anything else. That's true independent of how many collisions you have. When you have a lot of collisions, that's almost equal to that. And then that term almost cancels that term. Almost. But Brzezinski calculated the difference, which is proportional to 1 over the collisionality. Right? And that's how you get viscosity of the magnetized plasma.
And I don't understand, in Brzezinski equation, do we have particular evolution equations for perpendicular and parallel components?
No, you have an evolution equation for p perp minus p parallel. I gave it to you. On the next, here we are. That's an expression. There's a 0.93 there. That's the exact expression for what it is.
So it's not an evolution equation.
Well, this is
not
stationary.
Well, just like when you derive viscosity in a real case, you derive it from the Chapman-Enskog expansion, and you get it in terms of the velocity. Right? It's actually a distortion of the distribution function, and here it's a distortion of the distribution function.
Yeah, can I take the conversation away from these details and ask you a rather unfair question to comment on while you're being recorded? If I may. So you know about the collisionless MRI in ADF-like flows that people have been talking about, for example, at the Galactic Center, particularly Elliot and
Greg.
And Greg. And so am I right to conclude? I'm gathering two things, that there's a likely mechanism for the plasma to become rather collisional on small scales,
right,
from these fire hose and mirror boat instabilities, and two, that there's that MRI, that there's no role for Goldreich-Schrödinger turbulence as described by this mean field cascade in because there's probably no strong mean field. Is that right?
Those are two very different questions. Because of our conversation last week, I went back into AppJ and I looked up every simulation of the MRI I could to find out what we knew from simulations about the small scales of the MRI. There isn't enough resolution to tell.
Right. Sure.
Right. And there isn't, and nothing in the published literature convinces me that we know in the MRI what happens. What typically people do is they set the Prandtl number equal to 1, which it's not. There's a measure zero set of disks, Prandtl number equals 1. There's some with small Prandtl number and there's some with large. And just by definition, there's none with 1.
Yes.
So I think it's a very interesting question. Why is the small scale dynamics in something like the MRI? Is it like these homogeneous cases where we've got no mean field, where it's not Goldreich-Schrödinger at all on the small scales?
right? And I think that's a very interesting question because it speaks to when we get the dissipation.
Right.
If you look at these structures like this, on the very small scales, one would expect them to be reconnecting. And they may heat directly electrons in reconnection regions, and therefore you would have transfer of turbulent energy to electrons and not to ions. Whereas gold rectrida tends to damp on ions.
Right. And hence the all two temperature story, which
tends to hold up.
Yes.
So that, I think, is just beyond me, I mean, at this point, to really comment on that. The question of how that then interacts when you've got weak fields with these plasma instabilities that Greg and Elliot and Pratik Sharma are doing some simulations in which they put in this extra scattering as a parameter into the code.
You maintain merely a constant parallel to perpendicular pressure, am I right? And understanding how you treat that?
These fire hose Mirabeau instabilities occur at a very small scale. You can't resolve those in one simulation. So we have some pitch angle scattering models that trigger once you exceed the fire hose and mirror mode instability.
But you solve kinetic equation actually? Or?
No. So we're solving CGL-like MHD equations, but putting in limits on how anisotropic the pressure can get because of these micro instabilities.
I see. So you just impose a limit, and you don't actually know whether, I mean, you don't completely isotropize necessarily. The pressure.
Well, we haven't done anything to cure this problem in our codes.
Yeah.
Right? We just ran some Brzezinski simulations, and I was arguing for some time that those were the simulations that were relevant, both for hot disks and for clusters and things. And it came as a surprise to me that these equations that looked perfectly well posed are actually formally, in the mathematical sense, ill posed. They have instabilities on the grid scale.
Right.
And if you resolve things at the grid scale, then they have instabilities above the grid scale, and I don't know what they do, right? And I think that this will come somewhat out of the simulations that Pratik is doing. You know, supposing you put something in that resolves it on the grid scale, then there are slower growing instabilities somewhere between your inertial range and your end of your inertial range and your grid.
Your analysis. Scattering will depend on the amplitude of the saturation level of these. Right? So how do you calculate the saturation level?
Well, as Steve has said, the fire hose and mirror mode growth rates are extremely fast at the cyclotron scale. So they effectively just pin you to marginal stability. The pressure can only just barely exceed marginal stability, and it can drive as much of these these micro instabilities as you want.
So what you could do is here, the growth rate, one thing you can do is when you've got a given magnetic field, is you can say they grow until you pin that to that, right?
Quite a linear analysis.
Right. You know, we really should do some real plasma simulations and find out what they really do.
I correctly understand that you make simulations and the simulation shows some kind of instabilities, and this is the analytical way how you found these instabilities, is it so?
No, we made simulations, we threw them away, and we came back to understand it analytically.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
don't believe.
We weren't trying to understand the things, we were trying to understand the physics, and when we did the analysis, we found these instabilities, and we should have known they were there. I mean, they're well-known plasma instabilities. But it's not well-known that they're in Brzezinski.
Right, I don't think anybody's ever pointed out that they were in Brzezinski.
And this means it's not clear what you use for dissipation models.
You don't affect the electrons, only the ions.
Well, it's predominant, but there will be an electron anisotropy, but it's smaller because electrons collide faster. Right? So this is all proportional to one over the collision rate.
But you have Whistler instabilities on small scales.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, once you start opening up this can of worms, plasma instabilities, you know, you keep us in business for like years.
Right. This equation for the difference between parallel perpendicular pressure, right? If the derivative magnitude is zero, then they should be the same.
Yes.
Right?
So if you're not amplifying the field.
Once again, if you use this adiabatic invariant argument, then you will find that where magnetic field there is a sort of magnetic field amplifies.
You mean if they move along the stationary field?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, but then
you should think about the difference between parallel.
But then you have conversion of perpendicular energy to parallel energy.
By collisions.
No, collisionlessly, because you have the mirror force along the field. Right? And a distribution, Fermi shows this in 46, actually. It's interesting that he got interested, but he did. He showed that if you had a magnetic mirror and he had an isotropic distribution function at one point, that it would be the isotropic at all points along the field lines, even though the field converged and diverged. The pressure would be isotropic at every point along the field line. Because the distribution function can always be a function of the invariance. And one invariant is the energy. So if the distribution function is only a function of the energy at one point, it's a function of energy everywhere. Right? That's the solution of the Boltzmann equation, the exact solution. Right? So even though you've got field lines that do this, magnetic mirror, like that, you don't have P perp bigger than P parallel here. It's only when you dynamically change the magnetic field that you do this. And the way to understand it, of course, is when you're squeezing the magnetic field, there's that actually an electric field going around the particle orbit, accelerating the particle. Actually, it's electric field that does it. It's collisionless.
This is a non-collisional plasma that happens. It's bottles and that.
Yeah, sure. But
collisions, we just reach this, always isotropizing everything.
Your lens
of isotropy of a collisional is smaller than the length of this bottle. Otherwise, you cannot apply collisional and
hydrodynamic.
I'm saying
when you don't have collisions, even when you don't have collisions, in a stationary magnetic field that's not moving in time, it doesn't matter what its shape is, an exact solution is
if you start isotropic, you remain isotropic.
If you start anisotropic, then it becomes more anisotropic until collisions relapse it.
Yes, but if you don't have active collisions, then there will be anisotropic pressure.
Yeah, there will be some transient damping. If you have a scale, it's only true for an infinite system.
Yes.
If you have a scale, then you produce an anisotropic distribution.
Another question about your simulation. In the first part of the talk, you shown the box simulation. And as I understand, you have generation on all scales below the Nisker scale, amplification of the field. Right?
Yes.
But your preliminary argument when you show a vortex,
yes,
it shows only how you reduce the scale of the field.
Yes.
So you must have some larger scale from which you get all the small scale. And
you mean how you reduce it?
No, yeah. Well, it's easy to understand how you reduce it, but how you support all this, there's a larger scale.
So what's interesting, and this is why people forever were worried about, is that when you have stirring by some here, you're expecting to make small scale magnetic field.
Yeah.
And you're expecting it to go to smaller and smaller magnetic field. When you solve the equations, you find it grows at all scales. It doesn't all just go to smaller scales.
Okay, how do you explain it?
And that's what I try to explain with these cartoons. Okay? In 2D, which was Zeldovich's argument in 1957, you stir the thing, and whenever you amplify the field lines have to get closer together. Because you stretch this thing, let's do this, the field line's going to get closer together. If the field is going to get stronger, right, the reversals in the field have to get closer together, so eventually resistance kills it and it's gone.
Yeah.
That's 2D. In 3D, you can compress it in the direction the field does not change. So in this picture, the field line is going up here, and behind it is another field line going up. And instead of compressing in this direction, you compress in the third direction. And therefore, you can amplify the field without enhancing the dissipation. And those are 3/8 of the motion, if you count. In a statistically isotropic simulation, 3/8 of the motion do this, and the other 5/8
do this. And so when you look at what the evolution of the spectrum, the peak moves to small scales, but at any given scale, it still rises. And that's what happens in 3D. In 2D, everything moves to small scale. Just keep moving to small scale and disappears. Did you understand my argument? It's because some of the motions, you can, you've got feel like this in this direction here, but over here it's in this direction. And instead of squashing these two together, you squash these two together.
So what's shown here?
Yes.
So what's shown here is standing on the spectrum.
Yeah.
So it grows to which
point? It grows, and the peak moves to the right.
Yes.
Right? And eventually the peak hits here, and then it stops moving the peak. But it grows at every K and continues to move. Once the peak is hit here, right, you don't get the growth of you don't get the movement of the peak anymore. It stops the resistive scale.
So somehow resistive scales effects
would
happen from the
life on the resistance scale. No, this continues to grow here. Just continues to grow even when you hit the resistance
scale. Until
which point?
Until
it becomes dynamically important and then the B squared is big enough to affect the eddies that are stirring it. Until you go nonlinear.
Alright. So the shape of the scale will change when you will hit the
resistance scale. Yes, it changes. It gets a Bessel function shape.
This is not one of those cases where the shape of the spectrum is not meaningfully interpreted in terms of a cascade.
No, it's not at all, because everything is being stretched by the same eddy.
Exactly.
Right? It would say eddy, but all the eddies in this band here are doing all this work, and it's just being folded over and over again.
Well, just to point out again my whole voice on this respect. The question about the opposite case, if the magnetic quantum number is low, and there will be no small-scale field generation at all, is your opinion?
So there's no field generated below the resistive scale. It's called, this guy from Riga, what's his name? Gallitzin spectrum. It's k to the minus, which you see in low Reynolds. There's an issue that we're fighting about at the moment. About low Prandtl number simulations, like in the sun. Is there a homogeneous dynamo when the Prandtl number is less than one? And in that case, these are the other way around. Resistive scale is over here, right? And what you see is not much magnetic field below the resistive scale, of course, because it's diffused away, and you see magnetic field above it. But we find when the Prandtl number gets less than about an eighth, numerically we find this, that it goes away, that we don't have any dynamo. The field just decays. So Mestel was correct for the half of this.
What system
I should tell you on that.
What system is supposed to apply?
The sun. The sun has a Prandtl number of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5.
So the conclusion is that there is no dynamo.
So far, I've been able to predict that the field in the cluster ought to look nothing like it does, and that there should be no field in the sun. I've been very successful.